Side 3. Fantastic Voyage by Isaac Asimov. Continuing on page 94. As gently as she might, the nurse eased the cork base off the bottom of the ampule, revealing a small nipple centered on the otherwise flat lower surface. The tiny opening in the middle of the nipple was masked with a thin plastic sheet that would not stand up against even moderate pressure, but would hold firm against leakage as long as undisturbed. Moving quickly again, the nurse removed a stainless steel needle from the case and adjusted it over the nipple. "Needle fits," she said. What had been an ampule had become a hypodermic needle. A second set of claws swung out from the Waldo and was adjusted to the head of the plunger, then clamped into place. The entire Waldo, carrying the hypodermic needle and its two claws, now moved smoothly toward the large double doors that opened at its approach. No human being could, with his unaided eyes, have detected any motion in the liquid so steadily transported by the inhumanly smooth movement of the machine. Both Carter and Reed, however, understood quite well that even microscopic motion would be nothing less than storm-tossing to the crew of the Proteus. When the device entered the operating room and stopped at the table, Carter recognized this fact by ordering, "Contact the Proteus." The reply was, "All well, but a little shook," and Carter forced a grin at that. Benesch was lying on the operating table, a second focus of interest in the room. The thermal blanket covered him to the collarbone. Thin rubber tubes led from the blanket to the central thermal unit under the operating table. Forming a rough semisphere beyond Benish's shaven, grid-marked head were a group of sensitive detectors intended to react to the presence of radioactive emissions. A team of gauze-masked surgeons and their assistants hovered about Benesch, their eyes fixed solemnly on the approaching device. The time recorder was prominent on one wall, and at this point it changed from 59 to 58. The Waldo stopped at bedside. Two of the sensors moved from their place as though they were suddenly endowed with life. Following the long-distance manipulations of a quick-working technician, they lined up on either side of the hypodermic, one adjacent to the ampule and one to the needle. A small screen on the technician's desk woke to greenish life as a blip appeared upon it, faded, was reinforced, faded again, and so on. The technician said, "Proteus radioactivity being received." Carter brought his hands together in a harsh clap and reacted with grim satisfaction. Another hurdle, one which he had not been allowing himself to face, had been overcome. It was not merely radioactivity that had to be sensed, but radioactive particles that had themselves been miniaturized, and that, because of their incredibly tiny infra-atomic size, could pass through any ordinary sensor without affecting it. The particles had, therefore, to pass through a deminiaturizer first, and the necessary juxtaposition of deminiaturizer and sensor had only been improvised in the frantic hours of the early morning. The Waldo, holding the plunger of the hypodermic, now pushed downward with a smoothly increasing pressure. The fragile plastic barrier between ampule and needle broke, and after a moment, a tiny bubble began to appear at the tip of the needle. It dropped off into a small container placed underneath. A second bubble and a third followed. The plunger sank, and so did the water level within the ampule. And then the blip on the screen before the technician's eyes changed position. "Proteus in needle," he called out. The plunger held. Carter looked at Reed. "Okay." Reed nodded. He said, "We can insert now." The hypodermic needle was tilted into a sharp slant by the two sets of claws, and the Waldo began to move again, this time toward a spot on Benish's neck, which a nurse now hastily swabbed with alcohol. A small circle was marked on the neck, within the circle a smaller cross, and toward the center of the cross, the tip of the hypodermic needle approached. The sensors followed it. A moment of hesitation as the needle tip touched the neck. It punctured and entered a prescribed distance. The plunger moved slightly, and the sensor technician called out, "Proteus injected." The Waldo moved off hurriedly. The cloud of sensors moved in like eagerly reaching antennae, settling down all over Benish's head and neck. "Tracking," called out the sensor technician and flipped a switch. A half dozen screens, each with its blip in a different position, lit up. Somewhere, the information on those screens was fed into a computer which controlled the huge map of Benish's circulatory system. On that map, a bright dot sprang into life in the carotid artery. Into that artery, the Proteus had been injected. Carter considered praying, but didn't know how. On the map, there seemed only the smallest distance between the position of the dot of light and the position of the blood clot on the brain. Carter watched as the time recorder moved to 57, then followed the unmistakable and rather rapid motion of the dot of light along the artery, headward, and toward the clot. Momentarily, he closed his eyes and thought, "Please, if there is anything out there somewhere, please." Grant called out, having a little difficulty catching his breath, "We've been moved toward Benish. They say they're getting us into the needle and then into his neck, and I've told them we're a little shook." "Oof, a little shook." "Good," said Owens. He battled with the controls, trying to guess at the rocking motions and neutralize their effect. He wasn't very successful. Grant said, "Listen, why do we have to get into the, needle? We'll be more constricted there. Moving the needle will hardly affect us then. Another thing, we want as little of that miniaturized water pumped into Benish as possible." Cora said, "Oh dear." Her hair had fallen into disarray, and as she tried futilely to move it back and out of her eyes, she nearly fell over. Grant tried to catch her, but Duval had her upper arm in a firm grip. As suddenly as the erratic rocking had started, it ceased. "We're in the needle," said Owens with relief. He turned on the ship's outer lights. Grant peered ahead. There was little to see. The saline solution ahead seemed to sparkle like a dusting of dim fireflies. Far up above and far down below was the distant curve of something which shone more brightly. The walls of the needle? A quick sense of worry nagged at him. He turned to Michaels. "Doctor." Michaels' eyes were closed. They opened reluctantly, and his head turned in the direction of the voice. "Yes, Mr. Grant." "What do you see?" Michaels stared forward, spread his hands slightly, and said, "Sparkles." "Do you make out anything clearly? Does everything seem to dance about?"
"Yes, it does. It dances."
"Does that mean our eyes are affected by the miniaturization?"
"No, no, Mr. Grant," Michaels sighed wearily. "If you're worried about blindness, forget it. Look around you here in the Proteus. Look at me. Is there anything wrong with how it looks in here?"
"No."
"Very well. In here, you are seeing miniaturized light waves with an equally miniaturized retina, and all is well. But when miniaturized light waves go out there into a less miniaturized or completely unminiaturized world, they are not easily reflected. They're quite penetrating, in fact. We see only intermittent reflections here and there. Therefore, everything out there seems to flicker to us."
"I see. Thank you, Doc," said Grant. Michael sighed again.
"I trust I get my sea legs soon. The flickering light and the Brownian motion together are giving me a headache."
"Here we go," cried Owen suddenly. They were sliding forward now. The sensation was unmistakable. The far-off curving walls of the hypodermic needle seemed more solid now as the spotty reflection of miniaturized light from their walls blurred and melted together. It was like riding a roller coaster down an infinite incline. Up ahead, the solidity seemed to come to an end in a tiny circle of flicker. The circle enlarged slowly, then more rapidly, then yawned into an incredible abyss, and all was flicker. Owen said, "We're in the carotid artery now." The time recorder read 56. Chapter 9, Artery. Duval looked about with exultation. "Conceive it," he said. "Inside a human body. Inside an artery. Owens, put out the interior lights, man. Let us see God's handiwork." The interior lights went off, but a form of ghostly light streamed in from outside, the spotty reflection of the ship's miniaturized light beams fore and aft. Owens had brought the Proteus into virtual motionlessness with reference to the arterial bloodstream, allowing it to sweep along with a heart-driven flow. He said, "You can remove harnesses, I think." Duval was out of his in a bound, and Cora was with him at once. They flung themselves at the window in a kind of marveling ecstasy. Michaels rose more deliberately, threw a glance at the other two, then turned to his chart, studying it closely. He said tightly, "Excellent precision." Did you think we might have missed the artery? Asked Grant. For a moment, Michael stared absently at Grant. Then,
No, that would have been unlikely, but we might have penetrated past a key branch point, been unable to buck the arterial current, and lost time having to plot an alternate and poorer route. As it is, the ship is just where it ought to be.
His voice quavered.
Grant said encouragingly,
We seem to be doing well so far.
Yes. A pause, then hastily. From this spot, we combine ease of insertion, rapidity of current, and directness of route, so that we should reach our destination with an absolute minimum of delay.
Well, good. Grant nodded and turned to the window.
Almost at once, he was lost in amazement at the wonder of it all. The distant wall seemed half a mile away and glowed a brilliant amber in fits and sparks, for it was mostly hidden by the vast mélange of objects that floated by near the ship. It was a vast, exotic aquarium they faced, one in which not fish, but far stranger objects filled the vision. Large rubber tires, the centers depressed but not pierced through, were the most numerous objects. Each was about twice the diameter of the ship, each in orange straw color, each sparkling and blazing intermittently, as though faceted with slivers of diamonds.
Duval said, The color is not quite true. If it were possible to deminiaturize the light waves as they leave the ship and miniaturize the returning reflection, we would be far better off. It is important to obtain an accurate reflection.
Owen said, You're quite right, Doctor, and the work done by Johnson and Antoniani indicates that this might actually be possible. Unfortunately, the technique is not yet practical, and even if it were, we couldn't have adapted the ship for the purpose in a single night.
I suppose not, said Duval.
But even if it's not an accurate reflection, said Cora in an awed tone, surely it has a beauty all its own. They're like soft, squashed balloons that have trapped a million stars apiece.
Actually, they're red blood corpuscles, said Michaels to Grant.
Red in the mass, but straw-colored individually.
Those you see are fresh from the heart, carrying their load of oxygen to the head and particularly the brain.
Grant continued to stare about in wonder. In addition to the corpuscles, there were smaller objects. Flattened, plate-like affairs were rather common, for instance. Platelets, thought Grant, as the shapes of the objects brought up brightening memories of physiology courses in college. One of the platelets moved gently against the ship, so closely that Grant almost had the impulse to reach out and seize it. It flattened slowly, remained in contact for a moment, then moved away, leaving particles of itself clinging to the window, a smear that slowly washed away.
It didn't break, said Grant.
No, said Michaels. Had it broken, a small clot might have formed about it. Not enough to do any damage, I hope. If we were larger, though, we might run into trouble. See that? Grant looked off in the direction of the pointing finger. He saw small, rod-like objects, pushing fragments and detritus, and above all, red corpuscles, red corpuscles, red corpuscles. Then he made out the object at which Michaels was pointing. It was huge, milky, and pulsating. It was granular, and inside its milkiness there were black twinkles, flashing bits of black so intense as to glow with a blinding non-light of its own. Within the mass was a darker area, dim through the surrounding milkiness, and maintaining a steady, unwinking shape. The outlines of the hole could not be clearly made out, but a milky bay suddenly extended in toward the artery wall, and the mass seemed to flow into it. It faded out now, obscured by the closer objects, lost in the swirl.
What the hell was that? Asked Grant.
A white blood cell, of course. There aren't many of those, at least not compared to the red corpuscles. There are about 650 reds for every white. The whites are much bigger, though, and they can move independently. Some of them can even work their way out of the blood vessels altogether. They're frightening objects, seen on this scale of size. That's about as close as I want to be to one.
They're the body scavengers, aren't they?
Yes. We're bacterial-sized, but we have a metal skin and not a mucopolysaccharide cell wall. I trust the white cells can tell the difference, and that as long as we do no damage to the surrounding tissues, they won't react to us.
Grant tried to withdraw his too particular attention from individual objects and attempted to absorb the panorama as a whole. He stepped back and narrowed his eyes. It was a dance. Each object quivered in its position.
The smaller the object, the more pronounced the quiver. It was like a colossal and unruly ballet in which the choreographer had gone mad and the dancers were caught in the grip of an eternally insane dance. Grant closed his eyes.
Feel it? The Brownian motion, I mean?
Owens answered, Yes, I feel it. It's not as bad as I thought it would be. The bloodstream is viscous, much more viscous than the saline solution we were in, and the high viscosity damps out the motion.
Grant felt the ship move under his feet, first this way, then that, but only soggily, not sharply, as had been true while they were still in the hypodermic. The protein content of the fluid portion of the blood, the plasma proteins, the phrase came swimming to Grant out of the past, cushioned the ship. Not bad at all. He felt cheered. Perhaps all would be well yet.
Owen said, I suggest you all return to your seats now. We will be approaching a branch in the artery soon, and I am going to move over to one side.
The others settled themselves into their seats, still watching their surroundings in absorption.
I think it's a shame that we'll only have a few minutes for this, said Cora. Dr. Duval, what are those?
A mass of very tiny structures clinging together and forming a tight spiral-shaped pipe passed by. Several more followed, each expanding and contracting as it went.
Ah, said Duval. I don't recognize that.
A virus, perhaps, suggested Cora.
A little too large for a virus, I think, and certainly like none I've seen. Owens, are we equipped to take samples?
Owens said, We can get out of the ship if we have to, Doctor, but we can't stop for samples.
Come now, we may not have this chance again. Duval rose testily to his feet. Let's get a piece of that into the ship. Miss Peterson, you...
Owens said, This ship has a mission, Doctor.
It doesn't matter to...
began Duval, but then broke off at the firm grip of Grant's hand on his shoulder.
If you don't mind, Doctor, said Grant, let's not argue about this. We have a job to do, and we won't stop to pick up anything or turn aside to pick up anything or as much as slow down to pick up anything. I take it you understand that and will not raise the subject again.
In the uncertain, flickering light reflected from the arterial world outside, Duval was clearly frowning.
Oh, well... he said ungraciously. They've gotten away anyhow.
Cora said, Once we complete this job, Dr. Duval, there will be methods developed for miniaturization for indefinite intervals. We can then take part in a real exploration.
Yes, I suppose you're right.
Owen said, Arterial wall to the right.
The Proteus had made a long, sweeping curve, and the wall seemed about 100 feet away now. The somewhat corrugated amber stretch of endothelial layer that made up the inner lining of the artery was clearly visible in all its detail.
Huh, said Duval. What a way to check on atherosclerosis. You can count the plaques.
You could peel them off, too, couldn't you?
Asked Grant.
Of course. Consider the future. A ship can be sent through a clogged arterial system, loosening and detaching the sclerotic regions, breaking them up, boring and reaming out the tubes.
Pretty expensive treatment, however.
Maybe it could be automated eventually, said Grant. Perhaps little housekeeping robots can be sent in to clean up the mess. Or perhaps every human being in early manhood can be injected with a permanent supply of such vessel cleansers.
My God, look at the length of it!
They were closer still to the arterial wall now, and the ride was growing rougher in the turbulence near it. Looking ahead, though, they could see the wall stretching ahead for what seemed unbroken miles before veering off. Michael said,
The circulatory system, counting all its vessels to the very smallest, is, as I told you earlier, 100,000 miles long, if it were strung out in one long line.
Not bad, said Grant.
100,000 miles in the unminiaturized scale. On our present scale, it is, he paused to think, then said, over 3 trillion miles long, half a light year. To travel through every one of Benish's blood vessels in our present state would be almost the equivalent of a trip to a star.
He looked about haggardly. Neither their safety thus far nor the beauty of their surroundings seemed to have consoled him much. Grant strove to be cheerful.
At least the Brownian motion isn't at all bad, he said.
No, said Michaels.
Then,
I didn't come off too well a while ago when we first discussed Brownian motion.
Neither did Duval just now in the matter of samples. I don't think any of us are doing really well.
Michael swallowed.
That was typically single-minded of Duval to want to stop for specimens.
He shook his head and turned to the chart on the curving desk against one wall. It, and the moving dot of light upon it, was a duplicate of the much larger version in the control tower and of the smaller version in Owen's bubble. He said,
"What's our speed, Owens?"
15 knots, our scale.
"Of course our scale," said Michaels pettishly.
He lifted his slide rule from its recess and made a rapid calculation.
"We'll be at the branch in 2 minutes. Keep the wall at its present distance when you turn. That will bring you safely into the middle of the branch, and you can then move smoothly into the capillary net without further branching. Is that clear?"
"All clear."
Grant waited, watching always through the window. For a moment, he caught the shadow of Cora's profile and watched that, but the view from the window overpowered even his study of the curve of her chin.
2 minutes? How much would that be? 2 minutes as his miniaturized time sense would make it out to be? Or 2 minutes by their time recorder? He twisted his head to look at it. It read 56, and as he watched, it blanked out, and then, very deliberately, 55 appeared dimly and darkened. There was a sudden wrench, and Grant was nearly thrown out of his seat.
"Owens," he cried out, "what happened?"
Duval said,
"Have we struck something?"
Grant struggled his way toward the ladder and managed to climb up. He said, "What's wrong?"
"I don't know."
Owen's face was a contorted mass of effort.
"The ship won't handle."
Michael's voice came up tensely.
"Captain Owens, correct your course. We're approaching the wall."
"I know that,"
gasped Owens.
"We're in some sort of current."
Grant said, "Keep trying. Do your best." He swung down and, with his back against the ladder, trying to hold steady against the heaving of the ship, said,
"Why should there be a cross current here? Aren't we going along with the arterial flow?"
"Yes,"
said Michaels emphatically, his face waxen in its pallor. "There can't be anything to force us sideways like this." He pointed outward at the arterial wall, much closer now and still approaching.
"There must be something wrong with the controls. If we strike the wall and damage it, a clot may form about us and fix us there, or the white cells may respond."
Duval said,
"But this is impossible in a closed system. The laws of hydrodynamics..."
"A closed system?"
Michael's eyebrows shot upward. With an effort, he staggered his way to his charts, then moaned,
"It's no use. I need more magnification, and I can't get it here. For God's sake, Owens, keep away from the wall."
"Damn it, man,"
Owens shouted back.
"I'm trying. I tell you there's a current that I can't fight."
"Don't try to fight it directly, then," cried Grant. "Give the ship its head and confine yourself to trying to keep its course parallel to the wall."
They were close enough now to see every detail of the wall. The strands of connective tissue that served as its chief support were like trusses, almost like Gothic arches, yellowish in color and glimmering with a thin layer of what seemed a fatty substance. The connective strands stretched and bowed apart as though the whole structure were expanding, hovered a moment, then moved together again, the surface between the trusses crinkling as they closed in. Grant did not need to ask to realize he was watching the arterial wall pulse in time to the beat of the heart. The buffeting of the ship was growing worse. The wall was closer still and beginning to look ragged. The connective strands had worked loose in spots, as though they themselves had been withstanding a raging torrent for much longer than even the Proteus had, and were beginning to buckle under the strain. They swayed like cables of a gigantic bridge, coming up to the window and sliding past wetly, giving off their sparkling yellow color in the jumping beam of the ship's headlights. The approach of the next one made Cora scream in shrill terror. Michael shouted,
"Watch out, Owens!"
Duval muttered,
"The artery is damaged."
But the current swept around the living buttress and carried the ship with it, throwing it into a sickening lurch that piled everyone helplessly against the left wall. Grant, his left arm having withstood a painful slam, caught at Cora with his other and managed to keep her upright. Staring straight ahead, he was trying to make sense out of the sparkling light. He shouted,
"Whirlpool! Get into your seats, all of you! Strap yourselves in!"
The formed particles, from red corpuscles down, were virtually motionless outside the window for the moment as all were caught in the same whirling current, while the wall blurred into yellow featurelessness. Duval and Michael struggled to their seats and wrenched at their harnesses. Owen shouted,
"Some sort of opening, dead ahead."
Grant said urgently to Cora,
"Come on, pull yourself into your seat."
"I'm trying,"
she gasped. Desperately, all but unable to keep his footing against the sharp swaying of the ship,
Grant pushed her down and then reached for her harness. It was quite too late. The Proteus was caught up in the whirlpool now and was lifted upward and round with the force of a carnival whip. Grant managed to seize a stanchion by a reflex grab and reached out for Cora. She had been hurled to the floor. Her fingers curled over the arm of her chair and strained uselessly. They were not going to hold, Grant knew, and he reached for her desperately, but he was a good foot short. His own arm was slipping from the stanchion as he reached for her. Duval was struggling uselessly in his own seat, but centrifugal pressure had him pinned. Hold on, Miss Peterson. I will try to help. With an effort, he had reached his harness while Michaels watched, eyes turning toward them in frozen helplessness, and Owens, pinned in his bubble, remained completely out of the picture. Cora's legs lifted from the ground in response to the centrifugal effect. I can't. Grant, out of sheer lack of alternatives, released his own hold. He slithered across the floor, hooked the leg around the base of a chair with a blow that numbed it, managed to transfer his left arm thereto, and with his right caught Cora about the waist as her own grip gave way. The Proteus was turning faster now and seemed to be angling downward. Grant could stand the strained position of his body no longer, and his leg flipped away from the chair leg. His arm, already bruised and painful by earlier contact with the wall, took the additional strain with an ache that made it feel as though it were breaking. Cora clutched at his shoulder and seized the material of his uniform with vice-like desperation. Grant managed to grunt out, "Has anyone figured out what's happening?" Duval, still struggling futilely with his harness, said, "It's a fistula, an arteriovenous fistula." With an effort, Grant raised his head and looked out the window once more. The damaged arterial wall came to an end dead ahead. The yellow sparking ceased, and a blackened, ragged gap was visible. It reached as high and as low as his restricted vision could make out, and red corpuscles, as well as other objects, were vanishing into it. Even the occasional terrifying blobs of white cells were sucked rapidly through the hole.
"Just a few seconds," gasped Grant. "Just a few..."
"Cora?" He was telling it to himself, to his own aching, bruised arm. With a final vibration that nearly stunned Grant with the agony he had to endure, they were through, and slowing, slowing into sudden calm. Grant released his hold and lay there, panting heavily. Slowly, Cora managed to get her legs under her and stand up. Duval was free now.
"Mr. Grant, how are you?"
He knelt down at Grant's side. Cora knelt down too, touching Grant's arm gently, venturing to try to knead it. Grant grimaced in pain.
"Don't touch it."
"Is it broken?" asked Duval.
"I can't tell."
Gingerly and slowly, he tried to bend it, then caught his left biceps in his right palm and held it tightly.
"Maybe not. But even if it isn't, it will be weeks before I can do that again."
Michaels had also risen. His face was twisted almost unrecognizably by relief.
"We made it. We made it. We're in one piece. How is it, Owens?"
"In good order, I think," said Owens.
"Not a red light on the panel. The Proteus took more than it was designed to take, and it held." His voice reflected a fierce pride in himself and his ship. Cora was still brooding helplessly over Grant. She said in shock,
"You're bleeding."
"I am? Where?"
"Your side. The uniform is showing blood."
"Oh, that. I had a little trouble on the other side. It's just a matter of replacing a band-aid. Honestly, it's nothing. Just blood."
Cora looked anxious, then unzipped his uniform. "Sit up," she said. "Please, try to sit up." She slipped an arm under his shoulders and struggled him upright, then pulled the uniform down over his shoulders with practiced gentleness. "I'll take care of it for you," she said. "And thank you. It seems foolishly inadequate, but thank you."
Grant said, "Well, do the same for me sometime, all right? Help me into my chair, will you?"
He struggled to his feet now, Cora helping him on one side, Michaels on the other. Duval, after one glance at them, had limped to the window.
Grant said, "Now, what happened?"
Michael said, "An arteriovene... Well, put it this way. An abnormal connection existed between an artery and a small vein. It happens sometimes, usually as the result of physical trauma. It happened to Benish at the time he was hurt in the car, I suppose. It represents an imperfection, a kind of inefficiency, but in this case not a serious one. It's microscopic, a tiny eddy."
"A tiny eddy? This?"
"On our miniaturized scale, of course, it's a gigantic whirlpool."
Didn't it show up on your charts of the circulatory system, Michaels? Asked Grant.
It must have. I could probably find it here on the ship's chart if I could magnify it sufficiently. The trouble is, my initial analysis had to be made in 3 hours, and I missed it. I have no excuse.
Grant said, all right, it just means some lost time. Plot out an alternate route and get Owens started. What's the time, Owens?
He looked at the time recorder automatically as he asked. He read, 52.
And Owens said,
52.
Plenty of time, said Grant.
Michaels was staring at Grant with raised eyebrows. He said, there's no time, Grant. You haven't grasped what's happened. We're finished. We failed. We can't get to the clot anymore, don't you understand? We must ask to be removed from the body.
Cora said in horror, but it will be days before the ship can be miniaturized again. Benish will die.
There's nothing to be done. We're heading into the jugular vein now. We can't go back through the fistula, for we couldn't buck that current, even when the heart is in the diastolic stage, between beats. The only other route, the one in which we follow the venous current, leads through the heart, which is clear suicide.
Grant said numbly, are you sure?
Owen said in a cracked, dull voice, he's right, Grant. The mission has failed.
Chapter 10, Heart.
A modified hell had broken loose in the control tower. The blip indicating the ship had scarcely changed position on the overall screen, but the coordinate pattern had been critically altered.
Carter and Reed turned to the sound of a monitor signal.
Sir, the face on the screen was agitated. Proteus off course. They've picked up a blip in quadrant 23, level B.
Reed rushed to the window overlooking the mapping room. There was nothing to see at that distance, of course, except heads bent over the charts and quite obviously electric concentration.
Carter reddened. Damn it, don't give me that quadrant crap. Where are they?
In the jugular vein, sir. Heading for the superior vena cava.
In a vein?
For a moment, Carter's own veins were in alarming evidence.
What the thundering hell are they doing in a vein? Reed!
He thundered. Reed hurried to him.
Yes, I heard.
How did they get into a vein?
I've ordered them into the chart to try to locate an arteriovenous fistula. They're rare and not easy to find.
And what?
Direct connection between a small artery and a small vein. The blood seeps over from the artery to the vein and...
Didn't they know it was there?
Obviously not. And, Carter...
What?
It may have been a pretty violent affair on their scale. They may not have survived.
Carter turned to the bank of television screens. He punched the appropriate button.
Any new messages from the Proteus?
No, sir, came the quick answer.
Well, get in touch with them, man. Get something out of them. And put it through to me directly.
There was an agonizing wait while Carter held his chest motionless for the space of 3 or 4 ordinary breaths. The word came through.
Proteus reporting, sir.
Thank God for so much, muttered Carter. State the message.
They've passed through an arteriovenous fistula, sir. They cannot return and they cannot go ahead. They ask leave to be brought out, sir.
Carter brought both fists down upon the desk.
No. By thunder, no.
Reed said,
but General, they're right.
Carter looked up at the time recorder. It stood at 51. He said, through trembling lips,
they have 51 minutes and they'll stay there 51 minutes. When that thing there reads zero, we take them out. Not a minute before. Unless the mission is accomplished.
But it's hopeless, damn it. God knows how weakened their ship is. We'll be killing 5 men.
Maybe. That's the chance they take, and that's the chance we take. But it will be firmly recorded that we never gave up as long as the smallest mathematical chance of success remained.
Reed's eyes were cold, and his very mustache bristled.
General, you're thinking of your record. If they die, sir, I'll testify that you kept them in past reasonable hope.
I'll take that chance, too, said Carter. Now you tell me. You're in charge of the medical division. Why can't they move?
They can't go back through the fistula against the current. That's physically impossible, no matter how many orders you give. The gradation of blood pressure is not under army control.
Why can't they find another route?
All routes from their present position to the clot lead through the heart.
The turbulence of the hot passage would smash them to kindling in an instant, and we can't take that chance. We can't, Carter. Not because of the lives of the men, though that's reason enough. If the ship is smashed, we'll never get all of it out, and eventually its fragments will deminiaturize and kill Benish. If we get the men out now, we can try operating on Benish from outside. That's hopeless. Not as hopeless as our present situation. For a moment, Carter considered. He said quietly,
Colonel Reed, tell me, without killing Benish, how long can we stop his heart?
Reed stared. Not for long.
I know that. I'm asking you for a specific figure.
Well, in his comatose state, and under hypothermic chilling, but allowing for the shaky condition of his brain, I would say no more than 60 seconds. On the outside.
Carter said, the Proteus can plow through the heart in less than 60 seconds, can't it?
I don't know.
They'll have to try, then. When we've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however risky, however slim a hope, is what we're going to try.
What are the problems involved in stopping the heart?
None. It can be done with a bare bodkin, to quote Hamlet. The trick will be to start it again. That, my dear Colonel, is going to be your problem and your responsibility.
He looked at the time recorder, which read 50. We're wasting time. Let's get on with it. Get your heart men into action, and I'll have the men on the Proteus instructed.
The lights were on within the Proteus. Michaels, Duval, and Cora, looking disheveled, clustered about Grant.
Grant said, and that's it. They're stopping Benish's heart by electric shock at the moment of our approach, and they'll start it again when we emerge.
Start it again?
Exploded Michaels.
Are they mad? Benish can't take that in his condition.
I suspect, said Grant, they consider it the only chance the mission has of succeeding.
If that's the only chance, then we've failed.
Duval said, I've had experience with open-heart surgery, Michaels. It may be possible. The heart is tougher than we think. Owens, how long will it take us to pass through the heart?
Owens looked down from the bubble.
I've been figuring out just that, Duval. If we have no delays, we can do it in from 55 to 57 seconds.
Duval shrugged.
We'd have 3 seconds to spare.
Grant said, then we'd better get on with it.
Owens said, we're drifting with the current toward the heart right now. I'll shift the engines into high. I need to test them anyway. They took a bad beating.
A muted throb rose somewhat in pitch, and the sensation of forward motion overlay the dull, erratic trembling of Brownian motion.
Lights out, said Owens, and we'd better relax while I baby this thing along.
And with lights out, all drifted to the window again, even Michaels. The appearance of the world about them had changed completely. It was still blood. It still contained all the bits and pieces, all the fragments and molecular aggregates, the platelets and red blood corpuscles. But the difference... This was the superior vena cava now, the chief vein coming from the head and neck, its oxygen supply consumed and gone. The red blood corpuscles were drained of oxygen and now contained hemoglobin itself, not oxyhemoglobin, that bright red combination of hemoglobin and oxygen. Hemoglobin itself was a bluish purple, and in the erratic reflection of the miniaturized light waves from the ship, each corpuscle glittered in flashes of blue and green with a frequently interspersed purple. All else took on the tinge of these unoxygenated corpuscles. The platelets slid by in shadow, and twice the ship passed, at a most grateful distance, the ponderous heavings of a white blood cell, colored now in greenish-tinged cream. Grant looked at Cora's profile once more, lifted, as it was, with almost worshipful reverence, and itself looking infinitely mysterious in shadowy blue. She was the ice queen of some polar region, lit by a blue-green aurora, Grant thought quixotically, and suddenly found himself empty and yearning. Duval murmured, glorious. But it was not at Cora that he was looking.
Michael said, are you ready, Owens? I'm going to guide you through the heart.
He moved to his charge and put on a small overhead light that instantly dimmed the murky blue that had just filled the Proteus with mystery.
Owens, he called. Heart chart A2. Approach right atrium. You have it?
Yes, I have.
Grant said, are we at the heart already?
Listen for yourself.
said Michaels testily. Don't look. Listen. An unbreathing silence fell upon those within the Proteus. They could hear it, like the distant boom of artillery. It was only a rhythmic vibration of the floor of the ship, slow and measured, but growing louder. A dull thud, followed by a duller. A pause, then a repetition, louder, always louder.
The heart, said Cora. It is...
That's right, said Michaels. Slowed a great deal.
And we don't hear it accurately, said Duval with dissatisfaction.
The sound waves are too immense in themselves to affect our ear. They set up secondary vibrations in the ship, but that's not the same thing. In a proper exploration of the body...
At some future time, Doctor, said Michaels.
It sounds like cannon, said Grant.
Yes, but it lays down quite a barrage. 2 billion heartbeats in 80 years,
said Michaels. More.
And every beat, added Duval, is the thin barrier separating us from eternity, each giving us time to make our peace with...
These particular beats, said Michaels, will send us straight to eternity and give us no time at all. Shut up, all of you. Are you ready, Owens?
I am. At least I'm at the controls and I've got the chart before me. But how do I find my way through this?
We can't get lost even if we try. We're in the superior vena cava now, at the point of junction with the inferior. Got it?
Yes.
All right. In seconds, we'll be entering the right atrium, the first chamber of the heart. And they had better stop the heart, too. Grant, radio our position.
Grant was momentarily lost to all else in his fascination with the view ahead. The vena cava was the largest vein in the body, receiving in the final stretch of its tube all the blood from all the body but the lungs. And as it gave way to the atrium, it became a vast, resounding chamber, the walls of which were lost to sight, so that the Proteus seemed to be within a dark, measureless ocean. The heartbeat was a slow, terrifying pound now, and at each steady thud, the ship seemed to lift and tremble. At Michael's second call, Grant snapped back to life and turned to his radio transmitter. Owens called out, "Tricuspid valve ahead." The others looked ahead. At the end of a long, long corridor, they could see it in the far distance. 3 sparkling red sheets separating and billowing open as they moved away from the ship. An aperture yawned and grew larger while the cusps of the valve fluttered each to its respective side. There, beyond it, was the right ventricle, one of the 2 main chambers. The bloodstream moved into the cavity as though being pulled by a powerful suction. The Proteus moved with it so that the aperture approached and enlarged at a tremendous rate. The current was smooth, however, and the ship rode it with scarcely a tremor. Then came the sound of the thunderous boom of the ventricles, the main muscular chambers of the heart, as they contracted in systole. The leaves of the tricuspid valve ballooned back toward the ship, moving slowly shut with a wet, smacking contact that closed the wall ahead into a long, vertical furrow that parted into 2 above. It was the right ventricle that lay on the other side of the now closed valve. As that ventricle contracted, the blood could not regurgitate to the atrium and was forced instead into and through the pulmonary artery. Grant called out above the reverberating boom, "One more heartbeat, and that will be the last, they say." Michael said, "It had better be, or it's our last heartbeat, too." "Shove on through, full speed, Owens, the instant the valve opens again." There was firm determination in his face now, Grant noted absently. No fear at all. The radioactive sensors that had hovered about Benish's head and neck were now clustered over his chest, over a region from which the thermal blanket had been folded back. The charts of the circulating system on the wall had expanded now in the region of the heart and showed only part of the heart, the right atrium. The blip that marked the position of the Proteus had moved smoothly down the vena cava into the lightly muscled atrium, which had expanded as they entered, then contracted. The ship had, in one bound, been pushed nearly the length of the atrium toward the tricuspid valve, which closed just as they were at its brink. On an oscilloscopic scanner, each heartbeat was being translated into a wavering electronic beam, and it was watched narrowly. The electroshock apparatus was in position, and the electrodes hovered over Benish's breast. The final heartbeat began. The electron beam on the oscilloscope began moving upward. the left ventricle was relaxing for another intake of blood, and as it relaxed, the tricuspid valve would open. "Now," cried the technician at the heart indicator. The two electrodes came down upon the chest. A needle on one of the dials of the heart console swung instantly into the red, and a buzzer sounded urgently. It was flipped into silence. The oscilloscope record flattened out. The message went up to the control tower in all its final simplicity. Heartbeat stopped. Carter grimly clicked the stopwatch in his hands, and the seconds began ticking off with unbearable speed. Five pairs of eyes looked forward at the tricuspid valve. Owen's hand was set for acceleration. The ventricle was relaxing, and the semilunar valve at the end of the pulmonary artery, somewhere in there, must be creaking shut. No blood could return to the ventricle from the artery. The valve made sure of that. The sound of its closing filled the air with an unbearable vibration. And as the ventricle continued to relax, blood had to enter from another direction, from the right atrium. The tricuspid valve, facing in the other direction, began to flutter open. The mighty, puckered crack ahead began to broaden, to make a corridor, a larger corridor, a vast opening.
"No!"
shouted Michaels.
"No! No!"
His words were lost in the heartbeat and in the rise of the engines. The Proteus shot forward, through the opening and into the ventricle. In a few seconds, that ventricle would contract, and in the furious turbulence that would follow, the ship would be crushed like a matchbox, and they would all be dead. And 3/4 of an hour later, Benish would be dead. Grant held his breath. The diastolic beat rumbled into silence. And now?
Nothing.
A deadly silence had fallen. Duval cried,
"Let me see."
He was up the ladder, and his head emerged into the bubble, the one spot within the ship from which a clear, unobstructed view to the rear was possible.
"The heart has stopped," he cried. "Come and see."
Cora took his place, and then Grant. The tricuspid valve hung half open and limp. On its inner surface were the tremendous connective fibers that bound it to the inner surface of the ventricle, fibers that pulled the valve leaves back when the ventricle relaxed, and that held them firmly in position when the contraction of the ventricle forced them together, preventing those leaves from pushing through altogether and making a reversed opening.
"The architecture is marvelous," said Duval. "It would be magnificent to see that valve close from this angle." "If you were to see that sight now, Doctor, it would be your last," said Michaels. "Top speed, Owens, and bear to the left for the semilunar valve. We have 30 seconds to get out of this death trap."
If it were a death trap, and undoubtedly it was a somberly beautiful one. The walls were strutted with mighty fibers dividing into roots that were firmly fixed to the distant walls. It was as though they saw in the distance a gigantic forest of gnarled, leafless trees writhing and riven into a complex design that strengthened and held firm the most vital muscle of the human body. That muscle, the heart, was a double pump that had to beat from well before birth to the final moment before death, and did so with unbroken rhythm, unwearying strength, under all conditions. It was the greatest heart in the animal kingdom. The heart of no other mammal beat more than 1 billion times or so before even the most delayed approach of death. But after 1 billion heartbeats, the human being was merely in early middle age, in the prime of his strength and power. Men and women had lived long enough to experience well over 3 billion heartbeats. Owen's voice broke in.
"Only 19 seconds to go, Dr. Michaels. I see no sign of the valve yet." "Keep on, damn it. You're headed there. And it had better be open."
Grant said tensely, "There it is. Isn't that it? That opening?" Michaels looked up from his chart to cast the most cursory glance.
"Yes, it is. And it's partly open, too. Enough for us.
The systolic heartbeat was at the point of starting when the heart was shut down. Now, everyone, strap yourselves in tightly. We're slamming through that opening, but the heartbeat will be right behind us, and when it comes..."
"If it comes," said Owen softly.
"When it comes," repeated Michaels, "there'll be a terrific surge of blood. We'll have to stay as far ahead of it as possible." With determined desperation, Owens flashed the ship ahead for the tiny opening in the center of the crescent crack, semilunar for that reason, that marked the closed valve. The operating room labored under a tense silence. The surgical team hovering over Benish was as motionless as he. Benish's cold body and stopped heart brought the aura of death close to everyone in that room. Only the restlessly quivering sensors remained as signs of life.
In the control room, Reed said, "They're obviously safe so far. They're through the tricuspid and are following a curved path aiming at the semilunar valve. That's deliberate, powered motion."
"Yes," said Carter, watching his stopwatch in tense agony. 24 seconds left."
"They're almost there now."
15 seconds left," said Carter, inexorably.
The heart technicians at the electroshock apparatus moved stealthily into position.
"Aiming straight into the semilunar valve. 6 seconds left. 5, 4.
"They're going through." And as he spoke, a warning buzzer, ominous as death, sounded.
"Revive heartbeat," came the word over one of the speakers, and a red button was pressed.
A pacemaker went into action, and a rhythmic surge of potential made its appearance on an appropriate screen in the form of a pulsing swing of light. The oscilloscope registering heartbeat remained dead. The pacemaker pulse was increased, while eyes watched tensely.
"It's got to start," said Carter,
whose whole body tensed and pushed forward in muscular sympathy. The Proteus entered the aperture, which looked like a pair of barely open lips curved in a gigantically pendulous smile. It scraped against the tough membrane above and below, hung back a moment as the engine roar raised its pitch in a temporarily vain attempt to free the ship of the sticky embrace, then lunged through.
"We're out of the ventricle," said Michaels,
rubbing his forehead and then looking at his hand, which had come away wet,
"and into the pulmonary artery. Continue at full speed, Owens. The heartbeat should start in 3 seconds.
Owens looked back. He alone could do so, the others being strapped helplessly in their seats with forward vision only. The semilunar valve was receding, still closed, with its fibers straining their points of attachments into suckers of tense tissue. With distance, the valve grew smaller and was still closed.
Owens said, "The heartbeat isn't coming. It isn't... Wait, wait, there it is."
The two leaves of the valve were relaxing. The fibrous supports were falling back, and their tense roots puckered and became flabby. The aperture was gaping. The rush of blood was coming, and overtaking them was the gigantic baroom of the systole. The tidal wave of blood caught up with the Proteus, hurtling it forward at breakneck velocity. Chapter 11. Capillary. The first heartbeat broke the spell in the control tower. Carter raised both hands in the air and shook them in mute invocation of the gods.
"Made it by thunder. Brought them through."
Reed nodded. "You won that time, General. I wouldn't have had the nerve to order them through the heart." The whites of Carter's eyes were bloodshot.
"I didn't have the nerve not to order it. Now, if they can hold up against the arterial flow..."
His voice rang out into the transmitter.
"Get into touch with the Proteus the moment their speed diminishes."
Reed said, "They're back in the arterial system, but they're not heading for the brain, you know. The original injection was into the systemic circulation, into one of the main arteries leading from the left ventricle to the brain. The pulmonary artery leads from the right ventricle to the lungs."
"It means delay, I know that," said Carter. "But we still have time."
He indicated the time recorder, which read 48.
"All right, but we'd better switch the point of maximum concentration to the respiration center."
He made the appropriate change, and the interior of the respiration post was visible on the monitor screen. Reed said, "What's the respiration rate?"
"Back to 6 per minute, Colonel. I didn't think we were going to make it there for a second."
"Neither did we. Hold it steady. You're going to have to worry about the ship. It will be in your sector in no time."
"Message from the Proteus," came another voice. "All well."
Sir, there's more. Do you want it read?"
Carter scowled.
"Of course I want it read."
"Yes, sir. It says, wish you were here and I were there."
Carter said, "Well, you tell Grant that I would rather 100 times he..." "No, don't tell him anything. Forget it."
The end of the heartbeat had brought the surge forward to a manageable velocity, and the Proteus was moving along smoothly again, smoothly enough to make it possible to feel the soft, erratic, Brownian motion. Grant welcomed that sensation, for it could be felt only in the quiet moments, and it was those quiet moments that he craved. They were all out of their harnesses again, and Grant, at the window, found the view essentially the same as in the jugular vein. The same blue-green-violet corpuscles dominated the scene. The distant walls were more corrugated, perhaps, with the lines lying in the direction of motion. They passed an opening.
"Not that one,"
said Michaels at the console, where he labored painfully over his charts.
Can you follow my markings up there, Owens?
Yes, Doc.
All right. Count the turnings as I mark them, and then to the right here. Is that plain?
Grant watched the subdivisions coming at briefer and briefer intervals, dividing off right and left, above and below, while the channel along which they cruised became narrower, the walls more plainly seen and closer at hand.
I'd hate to get lost in this highway pattern, said Grant, thoughtfully.
You can't get lost, said Duval. All roads lead to the lungs in this part of the body.
Michael's voice was growing monotonous.
Up and right now, Owens. Straight ahead, and then fourth left.
Grant said, No more arteriovenous fistulas, I hope, Michaels.
Michaels shrugged him off impatiently, too absorbed to say anything.
Duval said, Not likely. To come across two by accident is asking too much of chance. Besides, we're approaching the capillaries.
The velocity of the bloodstream had fallen off tremendously, and so had that of the Proteus.
Owen said, The blood vessel is narrowing, Dr. Michaels.
It's supposed to. The capillaries are the finest vessels of all, quite microscopic in size. Keep going, Owens.
In the light of the headbeam, it could be seen that the walls, as they constricted inward, had lost their furrows and creases and were becoming smooth. Their yellowness faded into cream and then into colorlessness. They were taking on an unmistakable mosaic pattern, broken into curving polygons, each with a slightly thickened area near the center.
Cora said, How pretty. You can see the individual cells of the capillary wall. Look, Grant.
Then, as though remembering,
How's your side?
It's all right. Fine, in fact. You put on a very efficient band-aid, Cora. We're still friendly enough for the use of Cora as your name, I hope.
I suppose it would be rather ungrateful of me to object to that.
And useless, too.
How's your arm?
Grant touched it gingerly. Hurts like the devil.
I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. Just when the time comes, be very, very grateful.
Cora's lips tightened a bit, and Grant added hurriedly,
Just my poor way of being lighthearted. How do you feel?
Quite myself. My side feels a little stiff, but not bad. And I'm not offended. But listen, Grant.
When you talk, Cora, I listen.
Band-aids aren't the latest medical advance, you know, and they're not the universal panacea. Have you done anything about warding off infection?
I put on some iodine.
Well, will you see a doctor when we get out?
Duval?
You know what I mean.
Grant said, All right, I will.
He turned back to the site of the cell mosaic. The Proteus was creeping now, inching through the capillary. In the light of its headbeams, dim shapes could be seen through the cells.
Grant said, The wall seems to be translucent. Not surprising, said Duval. Those walls are less than 1/10,000th of an inch thick. They're quite porous, too. Life depends on material getting through those walls and through the equally thin walls that line the alveoli.
The which? For a moment, he looked at Duval in vain. The surgeon seemed more interested in what he was looking at than in Grant's question. Cora hastened to fill the gap. She said, Air enters the lungs through the trachea, you know, the windpipe. That divides, just as the blood vessels do, into smaller and smaller tubes until they finally reach the microscopic little chambers deep in the lung, where the air that enters finds itself separated from the interior of the body only by a narrow membrane, a membrane as narrow as that of the capillaries. Those chambers are the alveoli. There are about 600 million of them in the lungs.
Complicated mechanism.
A magnificent one. Oxygen leaks across the alveolar membrane and across the capillary membrane, too. It finds itself in the bloodstream, and before it can leak back, the red blood corpuscles have picked it up. Meanwhile, carbon dioxide wastes leak out in the other direction from blood to lungs. Dr. Duval is waiting to watch that happen. That's why he didn't answer.
No excuses are necessary. I know what it is to be absorbed in one thing to the exclusion of another.
He grinned broadly.
I'm afraid, though, that Dr. Duval's absorptions are not mine.
Cora looked uncomfortable, but a cry from Owens blocked off her answer.
Straight ahead, he called. Watch what's coming.
All eyes turned ahead. A blue-green corpuscle was bumping along ahead of them, scraping its edges slowly against the walls of the capillary on either side. A wave of faint straw made its appearance at the edges and then swept inward until all the darker color was gone. Other blue-green corpuscles making their way past them turned color likewise. The headlights were picking up only straw color ahead,
and the color deepened into orange-red in the distance.
"You see," said Cora excitedly, "as they pick up the oxygen, the hemoglobin turns into oxyhemoglobin, and the blood brightens to red. That will be taken back to the left ventricle of the heart now, and the rich, oxygenated blood will be pumped all over the body."
"You mean we have to go back to the heart again?" said Grant, in instant concern.
"Oh, no," said Cora. "Now that we're in the capillary system, we'll be able to cut across."
She didn't sound very certain of it, however.
Duval said,
"Look at the wonder of it. Look at the God-given wonder of it."
Michael said stiffly, "It's just a gas exchange, a mechanical process worked out by the random forces of evolution over a period of 3 billion years.
Duval turned fiercely. "Are you maintaining that this is accidental? That this marvelous mechanism, geared to perfection at 1,000 points and all interlocking with clever certainty, is produced by nothing more than just the here-and-there collision of atoms?"
"That's exactly what I want to tell you."
"Yes," said Michaels.
At which point both, facing each other in belligerent exasperation, looked up with a snap at the sudden, raucous sound of a buzzer.
Owen said, "What the devil?"
He flicked at a switch desperately, but a needle on one of his gauges was dropping rapidly toward a red horizontal line. He shut off the buzzer and called out,
"Grant, what is it? Something's wrong. Check the manual right over there."
Grant followed the pointing finger, moving quickly, while Cora crowded behind.
Grant said, "There's a needle in the red danger zone under something marked tank left. Obviously, the left tank's losing pressure."
Owens groaned and looked behind.
"And how? We're bubbling air into the bloodstream. Grant, get up here quickly."
He was shucking his harness. Grant scrambled toward the ladder, making room as best he might for Owens to squeeze past on the way down. Cora managed to make out the bubbles through the small rear window. She said,
"Air bubbles in the bloodstream can be fatal."
"Not this kind," said Duval hastily. "On our miniaturized scale, we produce bubbles that are too tiny to do harm."
"Never mind the danger to Benish," said Michaels grimly. "We need the air."
Owens called back to Grant, who was seating himself at the controls.
"Just leave everything as it is for now, but watch for any red signal flashes anywhere on the board."
He said to Michaels as he passed him, "There must be a frozen valve. I can't think of anything else." He moved back and opened a panel with a quick wrench at one end, using a small tool he had removed from the pocket of his uniform. The maze of wires and circuit breakers was revealed in frightening complexity. Owen's skilled fingers probed through them quickly, testing and eliminating with an ease and celerity that could only have marked the ship's designer. He tripped a switch, opened it quickly, and let it snap shut, then moved forward to look over the auxiliary controls underneath the windows at the bow of the ship.
"There must have been some damage outside when we scraped into the pulmonary artery, or when the arterial blood surge hit us."
"Is the valve usable?" asked Michaels.
"Yes, it was jarred a little out of alignment, I think. And when something forced it open just now, maybe just one of the pushes of Brownian motion, it stayed that way. I've realigned it now, and it will give no further trouble, only..."
"Only what?" said Grant.
"I'm afraid this has torn it. We don't have enough air to complete the journey. If this were an orthodox submarine, I'd say we would have to surface to renew the air supply."
"But then what do we do now?" asked Cora.
"Surface. It's all we can do. We've got to ask to be taken out right now, or the ship becomes unmaneuverable in 10 minutes, and we strangle in 5 more.
He moved to the ladder.
"I'll take over, Grant. You get to the transmitter and give them the news."
Grant said, "Wait. Do we have any reserve air?"
"That was it. All of it. All gone. In fact, when that air deminiaturizes, it will be much larger in volume than Benish. It will kill him."
"No, it won't," said Michaels. "The miniaturized molecules of the air we've lost will pass right through the tissues and out into the open. Very little will be left in the body by deminiaturization time. Still, I'm afraid Owens is right. We can't go on."
"But wait," said Grant. "Why can't we surface?"
"I've just said," began Owens impatiently.
"I don't mean be taken out of here. I mean really surface. There. Right there. We have blood corpuscles picking up oxygen in front of our eyes. Can't we do the same? There are only 2 thin membranes between ourselves and an ocean of air. Let's get it."
Cora said, "Grant's right."
"No, he isn't," said Owens.
"What do you think we are? We're miniaturized with lungs the size of a bacterial fragment. The air on the other side of those membranes is unminiaturized.
Each oxygen molecule in that air is almost large enough to see, damn it. Do you think we can take them into our lungs?
Grant looked nonplussed.
But we can't wait, Grant. You'll have to get in touch with the control room.
Grant said, not yet. Didn't you say this ship was originally meant for deep sea research? What was it supposed to do underwater?
We were hoping to miniaturize underwater specimens for carriage to the surface and investigation at leisure.
Well then, you must have miniaturization equipment on board. You didn't pull it out last night, did you?
Of course we have it, but only on a small scale.
How large scale do we need it? If we lead air into the miniaturizer, we can reduce the size of the molecules and lead them into our air tanks.
We don't have the time for that, put in Michaels.
If time runs out, then we'll ask to be taken out. Until then, let's try. You've got a snorkel on board, I suppose, Owens?
Yes.
Owens seemed completely confused at Grant's rapid and urgent sentences. And we can run such a snorkel through the capillary and lung walls without harming Benish, can't we?
At our size, I should certainly think so, said Duval.
All right, then. We run the snorkel from lung to ship's miniaturizer and lead a tube from miniaturizer to the air reserve chamber. Can you improvise that?
Owens considered for a moment, seemed to catch fire at the prospect, and said, Yes, I think so.
When Benish inhales, there'll be pressure enough to fill our tanks for us. Remember that time distortion will make our few minutes gray seem longer than it is on the unminiaturized scale. Anyway, we've got to try.
Duval said, I agree. We must try. By all means. Now.
Grant said, Thanks for the support, Doctor.
Duval nodded, then said, What's more, if we're going to try this, let's not try to make a one-man job out of it. Owens had better stay at the controls, but I will come out with Grant.
Ah, said Michaels. I was wondering what you were after.
I see now. You want a chance of exploration in the open.
Duval flushed, but Grant broke in hastily. Whatever the motive, the suggestion is good. In fact, we had better all come out, except Owens, of course. The snorkel is aft, I suppose.
In a supply and storage compartment, said Owens.
He was back at the controls now, staring straight ahead.
If you've ever seen a snorkel, you won't mistake it.
Grant moved hastily into the compartment, saw the snorkel at once, and reached for the packaged underwater gear. Then he stopped in horror and shouted, Cora! She was behind him in a moment.
What's the matter?
Grant tried not to explode. It was the first time he looked at the girl without an appreciative inner comment on her beauty. For the moment, he was merely agonized. He pointed and said, Look at that! She looked and turned a white face toward him.
I don't understand.
The laser over the working counter was swinging loose on one hook, its plastic cover off.
Didn't you bother securing it?
Demanded Grant. Cora nodded wildly.
I did. I did secure it. I swear it. Heavens!
Then how could it...
I don't know. How can I answer that?
Duval was behind her, his eyes narrowed and his face hard. He said, What has happened to the laser, Miss Peterson? Cora turned to meet the new questioner.
I don't know. Why do you all turn on me? I'll test it right now. I'll check...
No, roared Grant. Just put it down and make sure it won't knock around any further. We've got to get our oxygen before we do anything else. He began handing out the suits. Owens had come down from the bubble. He said,
The ship's controls are locked in place. We won't be going anywhere here in the capillary anyway. My God, the laser!
Don't you start, screamed Cora, eyes now swimming in tears.
Michael said clumsily,
No, Cora, it won't help if you break down. Later, we'll consider this carefully. It must have been knocked loose in the whirlpool. Clearly an accident.
Grant said, Captain Owens, connect this end of the snorkel to the miniaturizer. The rest of us will get into our suits, and I hope someone shows me quickly how to get into mine. I've never tried this.
Reed said,
There's no mistake. They're not moving?
No, sir, came the technician's voice. They're on the outer limits of the right lung, and they're staying there.
Reed turned to Carter.
I can't explain it.
Carter stopped his angry pacing for a moment and jerked a thumb at the time recorder, which was reading 42.
We've killed over a quarter of all the time available, and we're farther from that damn clot than when we started. We should have been out by now.
Apparently, said Reed coldly, we are laboring under a curse.
And I don't feel whimsical about it either, Colonel.
Nor do I. But what am I supposed to feel in order to satisfy you?
At least let's find out what's holding them up.
He closed the appropriate circuit and said, contact the Proteus.
Reed said, I suppose it's some sort of mechanical difficulty. You suppose, said Carter with urgent sarcasm. I don't suppose they've just stopped for a quiet swim.
Chapter 12. Lung. The four of them, Michaels, Duval, Cora, and Grant, were in their swimsuits now, form-fitting, comfortable, and in antiseptic white. Each had oxygen cylinders strapped to the back, a flashlight on the forehead, fins on the feet, and a radio transmitter and receiver at mouth and ear, respectively.
It's a form of skin diving, said Michaels, adjusting the headgear, and I've never gone skin diving. To have the first try at it in someone's bloodstream...
The ship's wireless tapped urgently. Michael said,
hadn't you better answer that?
And get into a conversation, said Grant impatiently. There'll be time for talk when we're done. Here, help me.
Cora guided the plastic-shielded helmet over Grant's head and snapped it into place. Grant's voice, transmuted at once into the faintly distorted version that comes over a small radio, sounded in her ear.
Thanks, Cora.
She nodded at him dolefully. One by one, they used the escape hatch. Precious air had to be consumed by forcing blood plasma out of the hatch each time. Grant found himself paddling in a fluid that was not even as clear as the water one would find on the average polluted beach. It was full of floating debris, flecks, and bits of matter. The Proteus filled half the diameter of the capillary, and past it, red blood corpuscles nudged their way. Periodically, smaller platelets passed, with more room to spare. Grant said uneasily,
If platelets break against the Proteus, we may form a clot.
We may, said Duval, but it won't be dangerous here, not in a capillary.
They could see Owens within the ship. He lifted his head and revealed an anxious face. He nodded and moved his hand without enthusiasm, trying to dodge and turn so as to be visible between and among the endlessly passing corpuscles. He put on the headgear of his own swimsuit and spoke into its transmitter. He said,
I think I've got it arranged here. Anyway, I've done my best. Are you ready to have me release the snorkel?
Go ahead, said Grant.
It came out of the special release hatch like a cobra coming out of a fakir's basket at the sound of the pipes. Grant seized it. Michael said,
Oh, hell, in a sort of whisper.
Then, more loudly, and in a tone that seemed saturated with chagrin, he said,
Consider how narrow the bore of that snorkel is, all of you. It looks as big around as a man's arm, but how big is a man's arm on our scale?
What of it? Said Grant shortly. He had a firm grip on the snorkel now, and he put his back into moving with it toward the capillary wall, disregarding the soreness of his left biceps.
Grab hold, will you, and help pull?
Michael said,
There's no point to it. Don't you understand? It should have occurred to me sooner, but the air won't go through that thing.
What?
Not quickly enough. Unminiaturized air molecules are quite big compared to the opening in that snorkel. Do you expect air to leak through a tiny tube that you could barely see through a microscope?
The air will be under lung pressure.
So what?
Ever hear of a slow leak in an automobile tire? The hole through which air leaks in such a tire is probably no smaller than that, and is under considerably more pressure than a lung can generate, and it's a slow leak.
Hell, and Michaels grimaced lugubriously, I wish I had thought of this sooner.
Grant roared,
Owens, I hear you. Don't crack every eardrum in existence. Never mind hearing me. Did you hear Michaels?
Yes, I did.
Is he right? You're the nearest thing to a miniaturization expert we have. Is he right?
Well, yes and no, said Owens.
And what the devil does that mean?
It means, yes, the air will go through the snorkel only very slowly unless it is miniaturized, and no, we need not worry if I can succeed in miniaturizing it. I can extend the field through the snorkel and miniaturize the air on the other side and suck that through by...
Won't such a field extension affect us? Put in Michaels.
No, I'll have it set for a fixed maximum of miniaturization, and we're there already.
How about the surrounding blood and lung tissue? Asked Duval.
There's a limit to how sharply selective I can make the field, admitted Owens. This is only a small miniaturizer I have here, but I can confine it to gas, that is, to substances of low density. There's bound to be some damage, however. I just hope it won't be too much.
We'll have to chance it, that's all, said Grant. Let's get on with it. We can't take forever.
With four pairs of arms encircling the snorkel and four pairs of legs pumping away, it reached the capillary wall. For a moment, Grant hesitated.
We're going to have to cut through. Duval.
Duval's lips curved in a small smile.
There's no need to call on the surgeon. At this microscopic level, you would do as well. There is no skill needed.
He drew a knife from a small scabbard at his waist and looked at it.
It undoubtedly has miniaturized bacteria on it. Eventually, they will deminiaturize in the bloodstream, but the white cells will take care of them then. Nothing pathogenic in any case, I hope.
Please get on with it, doctor, said Grant urgently. Duval slashed neatly with his knife between two of the cells that made up the capillary. A neat slit opened. The thickness of the wall might be a 1/10,000th of an inch in the world generally, but on their own miniaturized scale, the thickness amounted to several yards. Duval stepped into the slit and forced his way through, breaking strands of intercellular cement and cutting farther. The wall was perforated at last, and the cells drew apart, like the lips of a gaping wound. Through the wound could be seen another set of cells, at which Duval slashed neatly and with precision. He returned and said, It's a microscopic opening. There'll be no loss of blood to speak of.
No loss at all, said Michaels emphatically. The leakage is the other way.
And indeed, a bubble of air seemed to bulge inward at the opening. It bulged farther and then stopped. Michaels put his hand to the bubble. A portion of its surface pushed inward, but the hand did not go through.
Surface tension, he said.
What now? Demanded Grant.
Surface tension, I tell you. At any liquid surface, there is a kind of skin effect. To something as large as a human being, an unminiaturized human being, the effect is too small to be noticed. But insects can walk on water surfaces because of it. In our miniaturized state, the effect is even stronger. We may not be able to get beyond the barrier.
Michaels drew his knife and plunged it into the fluid gas interface, as a moment before Duval had operated on the cells. The knife forced the interface forward into a point, then broke through.
It's like cutting thin rubber, said Michaels, panting a bit.
He sliced downward, and an opening appeared briefly but closed almost at once, healing itself. Grant tried the same thing, forcing his hand through the opening before it closed. He winced a bit as the water molecules closed in.
It's got a grip on it, you know.
Duval said somberly,
If you calculated the size of those water molecules on our scale, you'd be astonished. You could make them out with a hand lens. In fact,
Michael said,
In fact, you're sorry you didn't bring a hand lens. I've got news for you, Duval. You wouldn't see much. You would magnify the wave properties as well as the particle properties of atoms and subatomic particles. Anything you see, even by the reflection of miniaturized light, would be too hazy to do you much good.
Cora said, Is that why nothing really looks sharp? I thought it was just because we were seeing things through blood plasma.
The plasma is a factor, certainly. But in addition, the general graininess of the universe becomes much larger as we become much smaller. It's like looking really closely at an old-fashioned newspaper photograph. You see the dots more clearly, and it becomes hazy.
Grant was paying little attention to the conversation. His arm was through the interface, and with it he was tearing away to make room for his other arm and his head. For a moment, the fluid closed about his neck, and he felt strangled.
Hold my legs, will you? He called.
Duval said, I've got them. Half his body was through now, and he could look through the crevice Duval had made through the walls.
All right, pull me down again.
He came down, and the interface closed behind him with a popping sound. He said,
Now let's see what we can do about the snorkel. Heave-ho!
It was quite useless. The blunt end of the snorkel made not a dent on the tightly knit skin of water molecules on the air bubble. Knives cut that skin to shreds so that parts of the snorkel got through, but the instant the interface was left to itself, surface tension would take over and the snorkel would pop out. Michaels was panting with effort.
I don't think we're going to make it.
We've got to, said Grant. Look, I'm getting in, all the way in. When you push the snorkel through, I'll grab whatever part makes it and pull. Between pushing and pulling...
You can't go in there, Grant, said Duval. You'll be sucked in and lost.
Michael said,
We can use a lifeline. Right here, Grant.
He indicated the neatly nested line at Grant's left hip.
Duval, take this back to the ship and attach it, and we'll get Grant through.
Duval took the end handed him, rather uncertainly, and swam back toward the ship.
Cora said, But how will you get back? Suppose you can't push through the surface tension again.
Sure I will. Besides, don't confuse the situation by taking up problem number two while problem number one is still with us. Owens, within the ship, watched tensely as Duval swam up.
Do you need another pair of hands out there? He asked.
Duval said,
I don't think so. Besides, your pair is needed at the miniaturizer.
He hitched the safety line to a small ring on the ship's metal skin and waved his arm.
Okay, Grant.
Grant waved back. His second penetration of the interface was more quickly done, for he had the knack now. First a slit, then one arm. Ouch, the bruised bicep. Then the other. Then a strenuous push against the interface with his arms, and a kick with his finned legs, and he popped out like a watermelon seed from between finger and thumb. He found himself between the two sticky walls of the intercellular slit. He looked down at Michael's face, clearly visible but somewhat distorted to the curve of the interface.
Push it through, Michaels.
Through the interface, he could make out a thrashing of limbs, the swing of an arm holding a knife. And then the blunt metal end of the snorkel made a partial appearance. Grant knelt and seized it. Bracing his back against one side of the crevice and his feet against the other, he pulled. The interface rose with it, clinging to it all about. Grant worked his way upward and ahead of it, gasping out,
Push! Push!
It broke through, clear at last. Inside, the tube of the snorkel was fluid, clinging motionlessly.
Grant said, I'm going to get it up through now, into the alveolus.
Michael said,
When you get to the alveolus, be careful. I don't know how you'll be affected by inhalation and exhalation, but you're liable to find yourself in a hurricane.
Grant was moving upward, yanking at the snorkel as he found purchases for gripping fingers and kicking feet in the soft, yielding tissue. His head rose beyond the alveolar wall, and quite suddenly he was in another world. The light from the Proteus penetrated through what seemed to him a vast thickness of tissue, and in its muted intensity, the alveolus was a tremendous cavern, with walls that glinted moistly and distantly. About him were crags and boulders of all sizes and colors, sparkling iridescently as the inefficient reflection of miniaturized light gave them all a spuriously beautiful luster. He could see now that the edges of the boulders remained hazy even without the presence of slowly swirling fluid to account for it.
Grant said, This place is full of rocks.
Dust and grit, I imagine, came Michael's voice. Dust and grit. The legacy of living in civilization, of breathing unfiltered air. The lungs are a one-way passage. We can take dust in, but there's no way of pushing it out again.
Owens put in, Do your best to hold the snorkel over your head, will you? I don't want any fluid plugging it.
Now. Grant heaved it high.
Let me know when you've had enough, Owens, he panted.
I will.
Is it working?
It sure is. I have the field adjusted strobophilically so that it acts in rapid spurts according to the... Well, never mind. The point is, the field is never on long enough to affect liquids or solids significantly, but it is miniaturizing gases at a great rate. I've got the field extended far beyond Benish into the atmosphere of the operating room.
Is that safe? Asked Grant.
It's the only way we can get enough air. We have to have thousands of times as much air as all of Benish's lungs contain, and miniaturize it all. Is it safe? Good Lord, man, I'm sucking it in right through Benish's tissues without even affecting his respiration. Oh, if I only had a larger snorkel.
Owen sounded as gay and excited as a youngster on his first date. Michael's voice in Grant's ear said,
How are you being affected by Benish's breathing?
Grant looked quickly at the alveolar membrane. It seemed stretched and taut under his foot, so he guessed he was witnessing the slow, slow end of an inhalation. Slow in any case. Slower because of the hypothermia. Slower still because of the time distortion induced by miniaturization.
It's all right, he said. No effect at all.